It's really a pleasure to be here. And what I thought I would do is to tell you today about some work that's taken a genomic approach to the study of small RNAs using our data from the plant system and some other data. And I'll try to follow this pathway depending how the time goes. And because you haven't heard much about small RNAs in plants, I'll take a little bit of time to tell you some of the things that are a little different in plants and some of the things that are similar. And then tell you about some initial analyses of the small RNA profiles of two major model plants. One is called Arabidopsis and the other rice, using deep profiling approaches, deep sequencing, with a technology called massively parallel signature sequencing. And then I'll talk about additional work using this technology and also 454 sequencing and some other approaches to examine small RNAs in different mutants of the main plant we use, Arabidopsis, but also one mutant in particular and why that was important. And then towards the end, I'll tell you about a brand new emerging way of profiling small RNAs that's much cheaper and much deeper, where I think, you know, we can start to use this much more routinely. And kind of look a little forward as to how we can put this together into the multi-network models and other models that are being developed. And let me just say also from the onset that the work that I'm going to tell you about is done in a wonderful collaboration between my group and that of my colleague at the Delaware Biotechnology Institute, Blake Myers. And Blake handles all the computational analyses within his group, so I'll try to answer your questions about that, but you may, you know, stump me and I may have to, you know, look to Blake to get some of the answers, and I certainly will do that in the after the talk if something like that comes up. So, as you know, the small RNAs can regulate genes at different levels, and from the lectures you've heard already, they can do this at the level of the DNA by causing methylation in the nucleus. They can also do that post-transcriptionally by inactivating the gene at the mRNA level, either by blocking its translation or by causing cleavage within the RNA. And the siRNAs, particularly in plants, are known to cause this gene inactivation at the DNA level. And microRNAs can either act at either of these two levels to inactivate the mRNA. And the cleavage event of microRNAs is very similar to like siRNAs in the very conventional RNAi. But one of the most prominent differences that there are is, or that there is that microRNAs in animals primarily function in this way. That is, they're associated with translational suppression, also with RNA decay, but it seems to be mechanistically a little different than in the plant system, where microRNAs cause cleavage of the RNA right in the middle of the base pairing region between the mRNA and the microRNA, just like in RNAi. And so nearly every microRNA in plants that has been found seems to work this way, with maybe one or two exceptions, whereas the opposite is true in animal systems. Yeah?
So I remember one of the things that I thought was really very interesting, actually, because it seems to be a perfect binding site, and yet it did not seem to have any effect on the mRNA levels, but rather on translational.
It's controversial. This is microRNA 172 that's been examined in a number of labs. And it's unfortunately that one targets a gene that could actually explain this whole thing by an indirect mechanism. So some groups feel that that's actually not a case where it's really translational, but that there is some cleavage. So I would be unable to really differentiate this at this point in time. So what I can say is the one case does base pair all the way across. It looks like it should cleave. Some people believe it cleaves as the primary mechanism, but it's just it's not as obvious because of some indirect effects of that on the biology of the plant. And others feel because you don't see a huge effect at the RNA level, but you see a big effect, you know, on the way it acts, that it must be, or on the protein, that it must be translational. So it's controversial at the moment, and we just say that there may be some that act that way at this point. Okay. Sorry, I have to keep walking across, but my advancer is out of battery, it seems like. Okay, so In microRNA biogenesis, the actual synthesis of the microRNAs, this has some different steps in plants than animals, but overall it's pretty much the same in terms of the events. So this is the animal pathway, and you can see here that the first step is to make the precursor RNA that you've seen probably many times. And then what happens is it gets trimmed by the first kind of RNase 3 type enzyme called drosha, and then it binds to a protein, and this precursor, this kind of short hairpin, comes out into the nucleus with exportin 5, and then it's diced by the dicer enzyme into the small duplexes, and then one strand of that remains in Argonaut to shut down the genes at the mRNA level by usually shutting off their translation. And in plants, the processing is all done by one kind of dicer. There's no drosha. So dicer 1 does the first cleavage as well as the subsequent cut to generate the duplex. And it's that duplex molecule that goes out into the cytoplasm. And then it gets methylated, actually, at the 3' end. And this is thought to protect it from decay and uridation, and then subsequently gets incorporated into the Argonaut as a, it's incorporated in the Argonaut as a single strand and targets the mRNA cleavage and decay from there.
Can you share that the exact same pathway is true for cases where the small RNAs may act on transcriptional silencing?
This one is just for the microRNA I'm talking about now. So it would be different for that. It's certainly, these steps are different. And I'll show you the differences in another slide for the biosynthesis of the siRNAs, actually. But a lot of these steps are different. The AGOs are different. The dicers are different. But in principle, there's dicers and AGOs for that.
But it's not happening just in the other
case. In the other case, some of it...
So is that back transport?
There's a lot of activity in the nucleolus for some of these SIs, actually. And the steps in terms of the localization are being elucidated, but there's certainly a lot of going back and forth. Yeah. Okay, so the small RNA binding modes probably dictate a lot of the differences that we see. There's two kinds of binding modes, complete base pairing and also the type of base pairing that we see typically in animal systems where the small RNA doesn't base pair very well but does tend to base pair, at least in the case of microRNAs, over the seed sequence from position 2 to 7. And examples of this that are very classical include the LIN4, the first microRNA discovered by the Rivkin and Ambrose labs, and also the this is just a typical plant microRNA, miR-166. And then there are exceptions to this, like there's this natural human microRNA that base pairs nearly all the way across and does work through cleavage. And then siRNAs typically work through cleavage, and they are designed usually to base pair all the way across. And you can make them, of course, not base pair all the way across, and then they act more like that. So in general, probably it has a lot to do with the binding mode. So in plants, there are two major classes of endogenous small RNAs, the microRNAs, of course, like in other systems, but there's this huge population of siRNAs that are made within the organism. And so, as I implied before, this huge population is made in a different sort of way than the microRNAs. And we went through the different steps of dicer cleavage and then incorporation of the molecules into the AGO, and then they cause the cleavage of the mRNA to regulate development in plants, stress, and other roles. And I'll mention those a little in the subsequent slides. But the siRNAs are typically coming from transposons and repeats, and they're synthesized from a single-stranded RNA that is then reverse transcribed by an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. And this makes the double-stranded molecule, and this double-stranded molecule is then diced into smaller duplexes, and then either strand of those duplexes can get incorporated into the final AGOs for the function in gene silencing. Either primarily they function in the chromatin modification step in the nucleus.
How the RNA polymerase recognizes which things to reverse transcribe? I mean, not reverse, but transcribe.
Yeah, so it's not known exactly how it knows to do that, and in fact there are multiple ones of the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, and so I'll get at that a little bit more when I get into the different kinds, but we don't know exactly how it knows which ones, but certain ones recognize only repeated sequences or primarily repeated sequences. So the pathway I've drawn here is actually primarily on the repeated sequences, and there must be something about that that allows a certain RNA-dependent RNA polymerase to function to reverse transcribe those. And also there's a different polymerase that's involved, this polymerase 4, that is also involved in the transcription of some of these loci. So
you're saying the transposon lands
The transposons in plants. There's a Pol IV that will, you know, generate some of these single strands. And I don't know if it's true for all transposons. And there's two kinds of Pol IV that do this. You know, different steps in the pathway. I don't think I'm going to go into that in this talk. But it's different from the Pol II that makes these transcripts. It's not to say that Pol II would never make a transcript through a transposon, but there's a distinct pathway that that can operate using these Pol IVs, both for amplification of the signal and also for some of the initial transcripts.
I wonder more, why am I getting these transcripts on Pol IV?
How long are the transcripts? I don't think I can answer that one. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, so how we got interested in this topic was we were interested in how RNA gets degraded in plant systems, and we were studying some of the degradation enzymes, and we were studying the 5-3 exoribonucleases as one class, and we're curious how these RNases work and what RNAs they degrade in everyday life of the plant. So we knocked out the enzyme and then did microarray analysis to find which RNAs were elevated in this mutant. And it turned out that this told us what some of the substrates were, and some of the substrates were the RNAs that were the remnants or the products of microRNA cleavage. And it turned out that our enzyme actually, which was a 5-3 exoribonuclease, was chewing up the 3' end after the microRNA caused the cleavage. And so this kind of got us thinking a lot about microRNAs, and of course they were quite a bit in the news in these days, and they affected the decay. And so this made us start to think of how could we understand microRNA biology in much more detail and in much more depth. And I also should mention that this observation was made first in plants, but it turns out to be the way that RNAs are degraded after cleavage like this in animal systems. The Isaraldo lab found similar results looking at siRNA silencing, that the XRN enzyme, which is a common 5-3 exo, does the same thing in flies. And so at the fundamental level, many of the steps, like I showed you in the biosynthesis, are the same for plants and also in animal systems. Okay, so because we were thinking a lot about microRNAs, and my colleague Blake Myers had been doing a huge amount of very deep RNA profiling just to look at the transcriptome in general, with this technology, massively parallel signature sequencing, which allows one to sequence small pieces of an mRNA from lots of genes at the same time, we started to think about how could we use such a technology to get at the microRNA profile or the small RNA profile in the plant Arabidopsis. And so in this case, we just cloned these small RNAs and then made cDNA out of them. So just isolate them out of a gel. And in Arabidopsis flowers, there's so many you can see them on an acrylamide gel. And then we attached a 5' adapter and a 3' adapter and reverse transcribe these, and then make this whole population of cDNA and give it to a company now called Illumina, but used to be called Lynx and then Celexa. They've been bought a few times. And they would execute a number of reactions with these cDNAs and essentially put them all on a bead so that each bead would represent one of the types of cDNAs. And these could be loaded into a flow cell and then sequenced with a very unusual sequencing technology I won't go into because it's now not used anymore, but a couple years ago was really the only way we could really sequence this deeply with any kind of technology. And what's important for the data that I'm going to show you is that each bead contains the amplified small RNA product of one of these cDNAs, and the beads are loaded onto a slide and sequenced for 17 nucleotides. So you get the first 17 from the 5' end in this technology, but the benefit of it was that you would get 350,000 sequences from each one run. But the disadvantage is you can't go all the way through the sequence. And that gave us a much higher resolution of things that we knew had small RNAs on them. So, for example, this is a gene that you might hear much more about in Rob Martinson's talk tomorrow, called FWA, and it's important because it's silenced by a couple of tandem repeats right at the 5' end of the RNA. And if you run a northern blot, you can see these small RNAs there. But if you look in the data set that we got, you could see there were 5 signatures from there, 3 of which were unique to just this region. And they were only in the flower, but not in the seedling. And so when you count up how many times you sequence a given small RNA, you get representation of how much of that small RNA was represented in your initial library. So this was really quite helpful, and I'll show you some other examples of this type of data, and that's a snapshot from the web viewer that Blake made. This is a little bit better version of the way we represent the data for the public. So this is just a region of chromosome 1 that's kind of typical, and each of the small RNAs are shown with these triangles. The open ones mean that they hit the genome multiple times, and then the closed ones hit only one position. And then these bars across the top, the red ones and the blue ones, are genes, and then the shaded parts are different kinds of repeats. And so typically on top of various repeats or retrotransposons, which are these yellow bars, you see a lot of small RNAs that are matching to those sequences. Sure. Some of them are unique to that locus, the ones with the closed triangles.
Right, but are you doing some PCR or something?
We haven't done that for the siRNAs. I think they're usually quite low abundance, so it's, you know, I don't know.
They're real.
Well, they go away in specific mutants that are in their biosynthesis. So that's, I guess, what we look at as the most biggest evidence. In Arabidopsis, we have this ability to, say, knock out the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. And then if the small RNA goes away, it's real. But whether it comes from that spot versus another spot, I'm not so sure how we tell that, you know, from even a PCR experiment, that it comes from there, because the only other possibility is it comes from a non-sequenced part of the genome, like a centromere, and it would be difficult with the kinds of PCRs that are available now, because you'd have to come upstream from there, and I'm not sure how you would actually show it came from that spot other than it only matches there and that it goes away in the mutant. But maybe I'm missing something?
No.
Okay.
How should I imagine the binding in such a repeat region? Is that unique, or could there be, are these triangles different small RNA molecule types, or can one and the same molecule in principle bind in different positions? In a repeat region, I could imagine that there's a hydrogenosity or possible binding.
You're exactly right.
Unique,
well, only the ones that are dark closed triangles are unique. Most of them actually are unique, but there's a large number that are repeated, and I'll show you different kinds of repeats and some other numbers in a little while. But yes, the ones that are closed are unique, and most of them are, but they may not be terribly abundant, you know. And then in the regions where there's a lot of repeats, you see this huge concentration. Now, these, of course, are mostly siRNAs. And so this... So those kinds of data are now available to the public and can be downloaded, and I'll talk a little bit more about the Arabidopsis mutants in a few minutes, but I do want to just take one sideline to tell you about a similar set of experiments with rice, and then do some comparisons to get at your question about how many, you know, are base pairing to repeated sequences and how those genomes compare. Because the rice genome is bigger, it's about 3 times the size of Arabidopsis, and it has much more repeated sequence as well, so it becomes a little more relevant. So in Arabidopsis, we sequenced about 2.2 million sequences and got about 77,000 unique non-redundant data set. And in rice, we did flowers, seedlings, and stems and got about a total of about, well, we got about 1.7 million from flower, and from seedling about 700,000. And you can see that just from the flower number, it's substantially bigger, both in terms of the total distinct and also the number that matched to the genome, 148,000 compared to 57,000 in Arabidopsis. And we did sequence more from the flower, but excuse me, from rice, but it, this is still proportionately higher from there. Well, I think you're asking mainly about the difference between the two systems. There certainly are two major reasons why there's a proportion that don't match the genome, and what, just without incurring any difference between those two tissues. One is that it may be two unsequenced parts of the genomes. None of the centromeres are sequenced in Arabidopsis, and also it could be mistakes, because these types of technologies are really made for either profiling in a general sense or just resequencing. So they're, you know, often meant to sequence a lot. Well, in this case, just certainly for profiling. They're not meant to be single reads and then believe the sequence. So there is an error rate, and that also contributes to the non-match. And then between seedling and flower, the thing about that is that there's far fewer small RNAs in the seedling. And so when you take the part of the gel, you cut out and you essentially amplify a lot of the background that's there. So you get a lot more ribosomal pieces that just happen to be in that region. And so I think that it could be just something like the fact that there are far fewer real small RNAs. And so you amplify some of the things that aren't real in seedling. But I can't rule out. Not if they're also, you know, well, yeah, that's true. They should map to the genome, yeah. But we haven't done this enough times to know whether this is, you know, something that is just that run or whether this is a seedling thing that's proportional, but you're right. I mean, if we could reproduce it and it's, you know, that significant, that might be something that would be real. But I tend to think it has some technical part associated with it. But I would imagine if we could sequence all the way through the centromeres of Arabidopsis, we would pick up a lot of that, and that might be that those are more abundant in seedling or something like that could explain that. So if now we map all the way across the chromosomes, these small RNAs, what we're doing now is putting a bar across the rice chromosomes of how many times we got a small RNA at a certain region, The picture looks really very dense in terms of the small RNAs mapping to the chromosomes. And in rice, these bars represent the centromeres, but these boxes represent completely sequenced centromeres, because in rice there is two of them that have been sequenced. But you can see that there's a really quite strong coverage across these chromosomes. And in this case, we're representing every hit of a different small RNA, not just any other kind of data, but just every hit is counted for every place it matches. And if you do the same thing in Arabidopsis, the picture is quite a bit different. You can see concentrations over 5 different spots in the 5 chromosomes of Arabidopsis, and these correspond to the centromeric, paracentromeric regions. None of them have been completely sequenced. And it doesn't mean that rice has really not a huge amount of small RNAs on top of the centromeres or that match to the centromeres, but it means that in the case of the Arabidopsis, there's a lot more in the centromeres than elsewhere, and in rice there's a lot everywhere. And we've done that in a number of different ways, like walk across the sequence with a rolling model and things like that. And there is a correlation with the repeats, certainly, but there's much more repeated sequences, particularly transposons, all retrotransposons and transposons all the way across the genome. And what that leads to is huge numbers of small RNAs in rice that match to the genome many, many times compared to Arabidopsis, and this gets a little bit at some of the questions that have been asked. And so in this slide, you can see the number of distinct signatures from these MPSS studies mapped relative to how many times they hit the genome. So in Arabidopsis, there are no sequences that hit the genome 1,000 times. But in rice, there's 250 sequences that hit the genome more than 1,000 times. And you can see there's a lot that hit many more times than in Arabidopsis. And so that's probably the reason for those distribution differences in that way. And there have been now other studies that have looked at the distribution in ways that are normalized in different ways. For example, like clustering them and looking at how the loci are distributed across the genome, and then normalizing the loci for how many times the small RNAs are repeated within the loci, and you still see this concentration in Arabidopsis over the paracentromeric regions, but it's diminished when you look at it where if you take every single locus and then divide by the number of counts, you can see it diminish. But there's still a concentration at the paracentromeric region. Okay. So our major interest in looking at these sequences has been to get at the microRNAs. At least that's one major goal. And so I'll give you a couple of examples of how we've done that. In the case of rice, what we did was we looked at small RNAs through a series of filters that are shown here. We looked at the ones that are conserved in at least three libraries, and then looked at the abundance, took things that were more than 100 transcripts per million, and then had hits of less than 20. And then from those, we took about 39 or so interesting signatures that didn't match known microRNAs or siRNAs that were known or other non-coding RNAs like ribosomals. Those clustered into 24 regions of the genome. And then what we could do is just do typical folding and see whether they folded properly and if, in fact, they had a microRNA star from the other strand of the folded element, and whether they did not. And we found 20 of those folded very nicely into these hairpins and had either a microRNA star in 10 cases or not. And a few of these had phasing, that is that they would be, each cluster of small RNAs would be phased like a 24 nucleotide and then another 24 nucleotide and another 24 nucleotide would be phased for the cleavage. And I'll get to why that might be interesting later. I'm sorry. Oh yes, and actually most of what we're looking at here is in the direction of going after microRNAs, but these are a kind of characteristic that could represent a type of siRNA that acts like a microRNA, this transacting. I'll get to that a little further, but that's the reason we did that filter. I'm not sure all those are that, but that's one of the characteristics. So this is just an example of some of the plant microRNA candidates that came from rice, and the microRNAs in green, and the star molecule is here in the orange. And I think there's probably been some discussion already that plant microRNAs have sometimes very long loop, if you will, sometimes that it's also base paired, and this is not atypical, even though these don't look like maybe human microRNAs, but they're quite typical for plant. And we can validate many of these, most of them, in fact, by small RNA gel blots. And this is just an example of the ones that had good folding and stars and the ones that had just good folding. And it shows also for flowers and seedlings. So you can see some of them are highly regulated in different directions. And so We think these are excellent candidates for real bona fide rice microRNAs, and they don't match the ones that are known already. And right now we're in the process of trying to validate their targets, which are much easier to do in plants. And I'll show you some examples when I get back to Arabidopsis. And we're also trying to apply some additional filters, mainly conservational filters, among some of the other related cereals to try to get at those.
What other plants are in Arabidopsis?
These are not conserved in Arabidopsis, in fact.
In all cases?
I don't know if all of these, actually, I can't remember that. The majority are not.
That tells me then that it goes deep, but when you discover things that are not observed.
That's correct. And I think this is not the best example to show you that, but I'll show you that in the Arabidopsis case, with some filters that are designed just to look at that. But most of the people would say, and definitely David Bartel would tell you this too, is that we've found the conserved ones already, most of them. And it's the ones that aren't conserved which are harder to find. So I can't rule out that none of these are conserved, but the majority are not, that they're unique. And this just is an example of the web viewer for rice. It's very similar to the Arabidopsis one, but it shows a lot more of these regions that are having repeats and small RNAs and things that match those that are not unique. Okay, so getting back to the biosynthesis again of the two major categories. So the microRNAs, of course, are made with the steps that I mentioned before. The siRNAs have a few different steps, but mainly it's the players that are interesting that are different. So most of the siRNAs in plants coming from these repeats require an enzyme or homolog of this enzyme, the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase II, which is responsible, as I said, for making the second strand of the transcript that generates the siRNAs. And there are multiple RNA polymerase, RNA-dependent RNA polymerases in Arabidopsis. And there's six of them, actually. And the dicers, there's also four dicers, so the dicers are different. So this is another nuance in Arabidopsis, which makes it very interesting. And we can see similar things in rice. In fact, there's even more players, more dicers in rice. And but in the case of the microRNAs, dicer 1 catalyzes the trimming and the second cleavage to generate the duplex, all those events. It's a dicer 3 that's in the same pathway with RDR2, but it's not unique. If you get rid of dicer 3, some of the other dicers can come in and can work as well, but not as efficiently on the RDR2 pathway. And so, in addition, the sizes are different. So from this pathway, it's usually a 21 nucleotide microRNA that's produced. From this pathway with RDR2 and DCL3, you get 24 nucleotide siRNAs produced. And then the AGOs are different. It's AGO1 that will be the effector complex with the microRNAs, and AGO4 will be the effector complex that complexes with the siRNAs made from the RDR2 DCL3 pathway. And
No,
it's but plus genetics. Yeah. So, and then DCL2 produces a 22 nucleotide RNA, and this has been associated with viral silencing. And then there's another kind of very interesting siRNA, and this is not maybe the only other kind, but it's certainly one of the most interesting, that's found in plants, and these are called transacting siRNAs. And they're siRNAs in the sense that they're still requiring an RDR to make them, the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase number 6. But what's interesting is they're generated first from either one or two microRNA-directed cleavages, of a non-coding RNA. So the microRNA will base pair with this non-coding RNA. There'll be regular microRNA-directed cleavage, and then that becomes the substrate for this RDR. So in this case, it has to have that kind of cleavage to be a substrate. And in the case of bees, it's thought to be, you know, sort of perhaps a localization issue in terms of where they are, say, in the nucleolus and in the nuclear compartment, for example. But in these cases, this is needing a cleavage. And then what happens is RDR6 will make this double-stranded long molecule from the single strand, and then another dicer, dicer 4, dices this in a phased fashion into 21 nucleotide RNAs. And then some of those go and act as almost like a microRNA in a plant and cause cleavage of another RNA. And so that's why they're interesting, because they almost act like a microRNA, but they're made like an siRNA. And they're very reminiscent of a class of amplification products that amplify silencing signals in animal cells that have just been elucidated. In very recently in Science, there was a very interesting set of stories about some siRNAs that could, or some small RNAs that could be made by RNA-dependent RNA polymerase that were amplifying, you know, the signals of some silencing. And this is a similar case, but it goes by a totally different mechanism, where in this case the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase is making the whole single strand, and then they're diced. In that case, it seemed to be making the small RNAs directly.
I think there's a fault there, and I think it's something, I think that's really maybe a connection, or is it just a coincidence? It could be, but I think that you think there's something behind this timing issue related to this specific pathway.
Well, I mean, I'm not the expert in this area, but I think that we don't have very many sets of these transacting siRNAs, and so that seems to be where they point to in terms of their effect. But that doesn't mean that we've got all of them, so they could, in theory, be regulating a lot of other things. And, you know, it's very tricky to try to find the targets of every single one of those, or to find, you know, how many transactings there are. But many people have done algorithms to look for other loci. Right now, there's only a handful of loci, or a handful of different kinds of TACI loci that make these things. And so,
but RDR6 is specific to this pathway.
Well, there's other things that RDR6 probably affects, certainly in the case of transgenes. But we've had limited luck trying to figure this out by doing, say, arrays with RDR6 mutants and things like that to look at what's affected. There haven't been huge numbers of insights about RDR6 roles on different genes yet. I don't remember anything about it being particularly regulated, but you know, we haven't looked at these things in a cell-specific way. I think people have just looked in general at different organs. I don't remember that, but you know, we don't work on that, you know, in great detail, so I couldn't say for sure. But Carrington has done RDR6 knockout and gene expression profiling, and you can find a few isolated things that are affected, but it's not that dramatic. The RDR6 mutant, though, can affect transgene silencing quite dramatically. For example, there was a group, Robert Sablowski, where they were overexpressing a gene that affected development, and they looked for mutants to try to understand development. And they found actually XRN4, our RNase, and that whole system was affected because there was too many siRNAs now made to the transgene due to the mutation in XRN4, and that was dependent on RDR6. And also RDR6 affects a lot of transgene silencing. So it probably has other targets in the cell, and there may be something very interesting there, but it's a bit subtle. You don't see a lot of changes. We've also profiled the small RNAs in RDR6, and it's just not that revealing in terms of other things other than the TACIs. But it's quite useful for that. So, and that also involves a different dicer, the dicer 4, I think I told you about, and the AGOs there are AGO 1 and AGO 7. And some of these TACI loci involve a second cleavage with a microRNA. So anyway, what our goal was to try to get at as many microRNAs as we could using the tools of these mutants. And one of the things we did was to inactivate or use a mutant that inactivated the major RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. And I'll show you a little bit of data for some of the others as well. In order to get rid of this whole pathway and then by enrichment elevate the level of microRNAs and some other siRNAs that weren't dependent on this RDR2. And so let's see here. So the RDR2 mutant is required for the biosynthesis of many, but not all, siRNAs in Arabidopsis, particularly those that correspond to the heterochromatic region of the genome that Rob Martinson will be talking about. I hope if he talks about plants at all, he'll talk about this sort of association. And then we used the inflorescence to sequence this mutant because we felt we would get much deeper coverage because that's the biggest source of small RNAs. And we were looking also to find some of the siRNAs that were independent of RDR2 to see if we could learn something about their biogenesis. And so in this case, I'm just comparing the summary of how many sequences, and this was done mainly with MPSS, but also a little bit with 454. Another sequencing technology I'll mention later. And what we found was that the genome matches and also the distinct sequences was quite reduced compared to the wild type, as we'd expect. And we only got 9,000 different things, even though we sequenced nearly a million molecules. And that's exactly what we'd hoped, that we would get rid of a lot of the siRNAs and enrich for our microRNAs. And this has turned out to be very useful. What this slide shows is, again, the matches. Every time a small RNA matched to the chromosome, its abundance is represented by these bars. And this was the slide I showed you before. And this is what we see with RDR2. And you almost can't even identify the centromeres in the small RNA profile here because they're so lowly represented among the sequences. So, and in this case, we really achieved quite a good enrichment of some interesting small RNAs that are summarized in this slide. So in the case of the known microRNAs, we increased the known microRNAs to 75, and the enrichment was actually in microRNAs that were novel, and most of these were from ones that were only in Arabidopsis, and I'll show you that later. And we also enrich these interesting transacting siRNAs even more than the microRNAs, up to 400 or so from 77. That is not clear, actually. You know, I'm not sure why we enrich for those so much. It seems that way. You know, we haven't looked at that further, but it's just very curious to us, you know, why that was. Because
as far as I know, nobody has looked at it. You take a mutant, the TASI pathway doesn't affect the RDR2 primary mutant pathway.
It doesn't seem to, but you know, we don't know you know, if there's some subtle effect that we haven't seen. Also keep in mind that when you look at this enrichment, you know, this is just straight sequencing, so we don't really know if it's going up or it's just an enrichment. You know, well, this is going up more than the microRNA, so we know that it's a bigger enrichment than that. But we assume a lot of it is coming just from the fact that the microRNAs are gone and they're huge amounts. But in terms of why that is, we really don't know. Okay, and then what's interesting among the repeats is nearly all of them go down. And the inverted repeat is the only exception to that, where the decrease in RDR2 is really not very strong. It's quite marginal compared to tandem repeats, retrotransposons, anything in the centromere, which were diminished as we'd hoped. And so we looked a little bit more at the scoring mechanism that we used to find these in the genome. And This score that we get for how good of an inverted repeat it is differed between those repeats that were the inverted repeats that were RDR2 dependent or independent, And this score was based on the percent similarity of the repeat, the gap in the repeat, and also the size of the repeat. And the only thing that was really different was the size of the repeat, and those that were independent were coming from a longer repeat. And it seemed like what we were seeing is the potential that maybe those longer inverted repeats could actually form a double-stranded molecule on their own and could be subject to Dicer cleavage even without having to use an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. And this is just one locus that could do that and give rise to small RNAs, just if this kind of structure could form and then be cleaved. We also saw that we saw a huge enrichment of microRNAs, and these are just the microRNAs that were elevated in the RDR2 mutant, and they vary quite a bit, you know, from one to another. Their average enrich is about 1.8-fold, and that's very similar to what was seen in smaller sequencing approaches. There were 8 microRNAs enriched by about 5-fold, and then the mutant that we examined, RDR2, we also found was very similar to a triple Dicer knockout mutant in terms of how it affected the microRNAs and many of the siRNAs, because that Dicer mutant is lacking in the DCL3, and 2 and 4 could substitute for it to some extent, as I mentioned, but they were all knocked out, and the results were quite similar to what we saw with RDR2. There doesn't seem to be a substitute for RDR2, however. So if you remove RDR2, you really don't have a lot of things jumping in this case, to generate other sizes of small RNAs. But the real reason we wanted to do that was to enrich for microRNAs, and so we wanted to use a series of computational filters to go after the microRNAs that were left in this population of, these 9,000 or so small RNAs that were left. And so we used these series of filters. There's 5 filters in this Venn diagram. The ones that we generated from our data are an abundance filter. So we're just asking for things that are greater than, I think down here, greater than 100 transcripts per quarter million. And then we were also looking at two other filters here, paired and sparse cluster. So we weren't wanting things that were densely clustered like this. We were looking just for things that were fewer than 10 signatures within 500 bases. And that's because microRNAs generally don't generate a huge number of small RNAs like SI clusters. This paired filter was asking for a small number of signatures within the so-called cluster within 20 to 880 nucleotides on the same strand. And we also asked for a difference between those that were in this small region to be tenfold, because we were asking for something that could be a microRNA and a microRNA star. Actually, this would be the micro and this would be the star, because the stars are usually degraded fast and would have a lower abundance. So those 3 filters we use from our data, and these 2 filters are coming from David Bartel's data, and they relate to your question, Nikolai, where you ask about sequence similarity, and they're folding filters. So this one folds the whole Arabidopsis genome and would match across all these sequences. And this one are those sequences in this AT-Set1 that fold up to be potentially precursors of microRNAs, and that match also to rice that could do the same. And so what we did was we stayed away from these boxes, again, because we thought that those had already been identified, and then really focused in on these sequences. And in fact, started to examine some from this box 3 and some of the other boxes. And so I'm just showing you some examples of some of these microRNAs. We identified another 13 new microRNAs. And these are on gel blots, but at this time we're using a lot of different mutants that either shouldn't affect them, like RDR2 or RDR6, or that should. DCL1 is the Dicer that should cleave these small RNAs, or the triple Dicer mutant. And here's just the MPSS signature. So you can see that all of these are absent in the DCL1 mutant, but are not affected are not decreased in the other mutants. And so that's... We haven't done that, no. So. But this is really strong evidence, I think, when you see that they go away in the mutants. At least it shows they're not some kind of decay product, and the specificity is quite, you know, specific. Now, one of the beauties in Arabidopsis is, or in plants in general, is because of this high level of sequence pairing between a micro and its target, targets are much easier to find. So, you know, you can design algorithms much more simply that can predict the target. Now, you can have mismatches up to, say, 4 or so. And so you do have to have some play in your target prediction, but it's much easier to design such programs. And we use one that is just mimicking one coming from David Bartel's lab, but many of the other groups, like Weigel's lab and others, have made really wonderful target prediction programs. Carrington's lab has good ones as well. And so you can predict what mRNA is targeted, and then you can also validate the target by mapping the actual cleavage site using 5' race. So you can just take the RNAs from your plant and ligate on to any 5' end that's been cleaved, another nucleotide, and just essentially amplify that molecule and sequence it. And then you can see where is the actual cleavage RNA. And so even though these were low abundance new microRNAs, we were able to validate 3 of them in terms of the cleavage site. And these numbers just represent how many of the molecules we sequenced were cleaved right at that position. And you can see that for these ones, we found very good cleavage, and the others we tested, we couldn't find it, but it may still be real targets, and some of these have actually been validated subsequently by other people. So the most interesting, I think, were this set of genes, the first two, because they were the first indication that genes that could be involved in pathogen resistance, these so-called MBSLRR, disease resistance genes, were targets of microRNAs, and subsequently other people have found that as well. So this was very interesting to our collaborator Blake Myers, because this is his area of interest. And this FBOX family proteins is a different member of the FBOX family, but FBOXes were already known to be targets.
Yeah.
I believe there are, actually, you know, and in fact, you know, we can only, if you make them too loose, then, you know, you just run that danger of getting too many things.
Right, so, I mean, that doesn't mean that there are many fusions amongst you. I mean, the same thing like an animal. You can also many things.
Absolutely.
You still have to do very extremely hard fusions coming out of it.
Right.
So in the opposite, it's not really easy to understand why it's and maize are quite far apart.
Yes.
So what is really behind this dogma almost that the plants are just running some simplistic algorithm and finds the targets and then it's done?
I don't think that it's done. I'm just saying that this is giving you some, gives us the best ones. And since we're doing a lot of experimental downstream work, you know, if we get too many, you know, like 5,000, it's very difficult to really validate them. And so, you know, that's why we don't expand it. But it doesn't mean that they're not there. It's just much, much harder to look at that. You know, what some people have done is try to obviously do microarray on the plant and then look at the correlation between RNA abundance and the predicted target, but that doesn't tell you everything anyway, because of, you know, you're sometimes looking at very small changes and you don't know if that's caused by that or not. But it can narrow your focus a little, but because it's so easy to make the major predictions, we've been able to get a lot of the targets just by not relaxing it so dramatically. But that doesn't mean...
Have you tried to just take artificial case, so to speak, where you have a same coding sequence that's partially complementary to a microRNA, if you say you can overexpress sort of the microRNA, you see effects.
Oh, sure, you see effects, yeah.
So then, if you, the microRNA comes on very strong, then you have huge production in time zone.
You would, and you're going to have a lot of secondary effects as well. And then sometimes when you do that in plants, you get this huge spreading of these transitive SIs that are kind of along the same line and require some of the same components as the TASIs. So like RDR6 is required, and so then you have to compensate for that. So it becomes complicated, but I think it's very valid that they might have many different targets. And in fact, you know, they could even be acting with a small seed, you know, and affecting some at the translational level, which is much harder to look at. So, you know, I wouldn't rule that out at all. I just think it's the early stages, early days, and we could see a much more dramatic effect, you know, as our ways of looking at it get a little more sophisticated. But I think we always have to come back and try to ground truth it in some experimental method, especially if we get, you know, relaxing the computational side quite a bit. Yeah.
But these targets can be coding and non-coding parts.
They're usually in the coding parts. Yes, and that's very different from animal systems. Now, that's not to say that there are not exceptions. There are cases where they're outside in the UTRs, but typically they are in the coding region. Yeah.
On the task scene, is it targeting non-coding
RNA? Yes, the precursor is non-coding. Yes, so it's the first RNA that's made is from a non-coding locus. That's cleaved with a microRNA. And then that's reverse transcribed. That's like the signal for RDR6. Then some of those that are chopped up in series become acting like microRNAs in AGO 1 and 7. So, yeah, that's a you know, kind of special case, if you will. But typically, they come from the coding region, and this could be because of the way the microRNA genes are thought to evolve in plants by first duplicating, say, a coding region or another gene, make a gene duplication and as an inverted repeat. Then maybe you get a hairpin and you're making a lot of these SIs from that. And then eventually it evolves where, you know, there's some selection for one of those to act like a micro and regulate things.
So plants don't have a drosa. So
right.
It's healthy, it doesn't require so many limitations as there have been in animals.
That's right.
And this way it's much easier to keep this duplication and go on.
Yes, and I think that's why probably the microRNA genes probably evolve differently, you know, in the plant system. Also because of just the way the genomes are a little more plastic and things like that. But certainly the restraints on, you know, generating a new microRNA gene might be different in the two systems.
And only a very short question. How are cutting these helping structures? They are cut out in the nucleus.
That's right. Dicer 1.
Dicer 1 is in the nucleus.
Yes, it is. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, but it, you know, the dicer may be also nuclear in animal systems as well. It came out where it wasn't, but I've heard a lot more information that that's not necessarily the only place it's located, you know, only in the cytoplasm. So, and our dicer 1 could also be, you know, found in the cytoplasm, but it's certainly in the nucleus. That's clear in plants. So. No, please.
Have you thought about doing these kind of e-sequencing methods by separating the nuclear RNA from the cytoplasmic RNA?
Well, doing the cytoplasmic is tricky in plants because they're covered in a really thick wall. So you first have to make a protoplast to get the cytoplasm out. You can't just break the cell without breaking like the internal organs like the nuclei. But you can get the nuclei out. You just can't get the cytoplasm free of broken nuclei. So we can make nuclear, but making cytoplasmic is a little more tricky. One would first have to make what we call protoplast by removing the cell wall, and then try to lyse those. And that could be done, but usually the procedures that involve those steps involve a huge amount of cell wall degrading enzyme preparations that come from fungi, and there's a lot of ribonuclease in that preparation. So we haven't really tried that, but I think it will be interesting to do nuclei and nucleoli because there haven't been a huge amount of analysis on large numbers of individual siRNAs in terms of localization. But like some of the major ones that have been used for that, you know, are in fact nuclear or nucleolar, and they can be found with some of these important components, you know, like the Pol4s and the dicers and so forth that are involved in that kind of synthesis. So this is work mainly from Craig Picard's lab and a little bit Steve Jacobson's lab was published last year. So the results of this RDR2 analysis included the discovery of 13 new microRNAs, and most of these were unique to Arabidopsis so far, 8 of those, and all of them represented new families. So these are not big families that were easy to find already, and this is also something that has been seen by other people like Bartel and Carrington when they're looking at some of the ones they've examined. The potential targets for these, number 10, and 3 of these we know are bona fide based on sequencing of the cleavage site. And we would estimate that there's at least 155 Arabidopsis microRNAs, and that's probably an underestimate. It was just generated by knowing, by predicting how many there would be and then trying to validate a random set from some filters and then back calculating essentially. So this is a very minimal number and there could in fact be more. And it's influenced by the fact that much of our data comes from flowers, which is a rich source, but we try to normalize for that. And then we found many interesting RDR independent siRNAs, and some of those could be actually TASI RNAs and other things.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you know how many TASI genes there might be?
Well, I mean, I would say that estimates are probably that there's just a few more, you know, like, you know.
So how many are there right now that are known?
I think there were originally 4 loci, and then I saw a report where there were another probably 3 or 4 that were identified. But many people have candidates that could, in fact, be validated later. We have a couple candidates, but other people have designed algorithms that would look in particular for those things. And with some of the mutants that are there, you know, that would make it easier to find. But it's not going to be a huge number. It's probably, you know, going to be very few. But they're particularly interesting. And I just put a slide here from a very new and I thought very good paper from Jim Carrington's lab, where they did a very similar analysis with 454 sequencing, not quite as big, and identified some new micros, and then kind of put the data together in a very nice way. So they looked at the conserved microRNAs and the non-conserved microRNAs, and I thought they counted about 44 families. That doesn't mean that's how many genes, or it could be a lot more genes there. That were experimentally validated. So these don't include anything that was predicted. So it's a very, you know, small set compared to what probably the real thing is. But I think you can see the different functions that have been really validated in Arabidopsis. And the transcription factors are the biggest class. And then there's quite a few things that are involved in the metabolism, and also some stress-related things, like sulfur stress induces a couple of them, and here's superoxide dismutase. MicroRNA and TASI RNA biogenesis, that is, there's autoregulation of some of the genes that are involved in the biogenesis, like AGOs and things like that, DICER itself. And then, you know, you can see a few more of the different things, including these disease resistance genes, and then some methyltransferases. So there's some relationship of microRNAs to some of the things that can affect methylation and chromatin silencing as well. So there's quite diverse functions, but transcription factors are one of the major things that have been seen with their analysis. In the non-conserved, I don't know. It's also, the non-conserved are not as well studied, so I think that as we learn more, we can get a better feel for it. But if we've got a representative group, then that's probably a big difference.
Yeah, you know, it's true that they are non-conserved as well. You look at, say, other more global processes like floating determination, these pie charts are quite comparable.
True. But the other thing is that a lot of these little slices are pretty small, being that there's only 44 families represented there. Now, some of them have multiple targets, so I don't know how big each slice represents in terms of numbers, but it isn't huge. So the fact that there are a lot more of the transcription factors, it makes it a little hard to compare, like if something's representing 1 or 2 in a slice.
The transcription factors of the non-conserved microRNAs in other things like rice, I mean, other targets themselves well-conserved in the conserved phase?
Well, what I can say is we've done a little bit in rice, and we see, in terms of transcription factors, things that are not as common in Arabidopsis. You know, something much more dramatic in rice that it's probably going to be conserved in other cereals. So I think the transcription factor is going to, you know, be a very interesting class of targets in terms of differentiating between plants, in terms of groups like families, and also in terms of, you know, just between plants that have these non-conserved. So I think it is a way that they can do something different, if you will, to help distinguish that species or groups of species. And we're early days, but, you know, it's the most dramatic change that we've seen in rice was we start to get into the targets. And we're just on the first few, but we can see there's a whole different class of emphasized targets in rice. So, yeah. So in the case of the other technology, so we did the very first, you know, analysis by MPSS because that was the only technology available at the time. The expense was enormous. It was costing us $30,000 for each library. So that's why we only did like flowers and seedlings and RDR2 and then some from rice. But the 454 sequencing had two advantages. And one was the way the technology worked was allowing one to sequence all the way through the small RNA, because at the time we started, 454 could sequence about 100 bases off their beaded system. And also, they could, and that was certainly plenty to get through the whole small RNA, but the depth wasn't as great. And so I don't know how much you know about the 454 sequencing, and it's just a bead-based approach that the beads are deposited in a well, and each bead again contains like one cDNA from a particular small RNA, and then these are sequenced in a more classical way than MPSS, using a coupled reaction, and then the emission is light, and that tells you how many you know, at which places the different base pairs are. So we did some 454 sequencing, and the first we used it for was in collaboration with Steve Jacobson's lab. Ian Henderson had made a mutant that was knocked out in those three dicers I told you called DCL234. So that was actually the first use of 454 for small RNA sequencing published by that collaboration with Steve's lab. And as I mentioned before, that one is knocking out the dicer that's in the same pathway as RDR2. And what happens in that mutant compared to the wild type, which is the green shown here, is that the size changes as you'd expect. So what we're looking at is just the size of the small RNA and how many times we sequence small RNAs from that size. And so in wild type, you see the 21s, which is the main size of micro, and 24s, which is the main size of the RDR2 dependent. And then in the case of the two mutants, you see primarily the 21s and very few in the 24 range. And we've done a number of other mutants that I won't show you here, but the website, if you scroll down from the web viewer that Blake made, he's got listed every library for a given small RNA region. So this is the microRNA 172. This is actually the one that is, you know, implicated in suppressing translation. These are a combined set from the MPSS signatures as well as from the 454 libraries. And so one could look at in this case and find, you know, the major microRNAs size either from MPSS here or from the 454 libraries for any of the mutants, like RDR6 is here and DICER1, which diminishes most of the microRNA classes. So we've been really, I think, very excited about the use of different mutants in the sequencing approaches to profile the small RNAs, and it's been very helpful. And I think in plants, we'll have a very good handle on which small RNAs are siRNAs and which are micros based on those mutants. We're going a lot deeper with the technology I'll tell you about in a few minutes. It's really given us the size information, which is another tool to understand the biology of these small RNAs. And I want to mention another technology that we've used. We're not relying on it terribly much now for a couple reasons, but I do want to introduce it. And I know that other groups are doing this quite a lot, particularly in animal cells, is to look at microRNAs and how they're regulated using arrays. So we did build an array together with Agilent. They're, you know, nearby, and their agricultural group was 20 minutes away, and so we had one of their leaders of that was an adjunct faculty member. So what we did in collaboration with them was to take their 44,000 platform of Arabidopsis orfs, it's called Arabidopsis oligo 3, and we added 2,500 sequences to that that represented different small RNAs that we'd identified in our analyses. We spotted those in sense and antisense orientation. These things were tethered using a 35 nucleotide tether so that they would be longer and, you know, attached to the array that way.
Okay, those 60 nucleotides.
Yes. Yeah.
The small
and hooked it to the tether. Now, what that means is that you wouldn't be able to probably hybridize to the ORFs at the same time as you hybridize to the micros, because the ORFs, of course, are much longer oligos, and so. But they had requested that we put it on this platform. But it's actually, you would need to hybridize them separately, you know, to the two. Later, we did do one where we just had the small RNAs, multiple times on an 11K version, which I think would be the one that should be commercialized, if any. So they're on in sense and antisense orientations, and we included microRNAs and microRNA stars and TASIs and various candidates from the Venn diagram and other small RNAs of interest. And then we labeled the low molecular weight RNA. This is, say, RNA 200 nucleotides or lower. We just used that preparation. It was a PEG precipitated preparation, and labeled those directly with Psi-3 or Psi-5 using a Createch kit, so the label's right on the RNA. And we did a number of analyses. I'll just show you a little sampling of that. We could see a lot of microRNAs or other RNAs that were regulated in response to different organs, seedlings versus flower in this experiment. These were twofold different in the direction showed flower more or seedling more. And then we looked at roots versus flower and saw some really big differences. And we could validate a number of these on arrays, both for knowns and on gels for knowns as well as for new ones. This just shows some clusters of things that were elevated in roots, elevated in seedling, or elevated in flowers in a preferential way. And many of those had been documented already in the literature, like the ones with footnotes. And we identified a number of new ones. And like I said, you could see a lot of this on gels. This just shows some of the new microRNAs and their regulation that recapitulated what we saw in the arrays. So, it's been useful. Unfortunately, the collaborator that we had is no longer at Agilent, and Agilent did away with their group that does applications. So it doesn't look like they're going to commercialize this array. The other thing is that I think as the sequencing technology for sequencing small RNAs gets much, much cheaper, it may not be actually cheaper to do arrays like it was when we first started this. I think as time goes on, it may not be cheaper. We did find at the low end the sensitivity wasn't tremendous, so we could see things on gels, for example, that were very reproducible that the arrays couldn't detect. And it could be something about the hybridization or the platform or so. But for big changes, we found it was quite useful. But how it will weigh out dollar for dollar as the new sequencing technologies come online, you know, I think remains to be seen. But, you know, this was an approach that we thought would be valuable to look at a large number of conditions for a more economical price.
On that last slide.
Yeah.
I thought BCL1 mutants were embryonic repo. Am I just wrong about that?
No, you're correct. And what people usually use is the allele DCL1-7. And so the DCL1-7 is not a complete null. And it's the, it's a mutant that is essentially, you know, defective. And so it doesn't completely eliminate the microRNA typically. And different microRNAs are affected differently. I didn't put that slide in here, but for example, microRNA 168 is almost not affected by it because it's controlled by some feedback loop with the AGO binding, and other ones are affected in a really huge way. So, we typically should see a decrease if it's a microRNA, This is a DCL234 independent RNA, which would mean that this one is, a dependent RNA. So this one could be an SI, and we think that is the case. It's certainly not affected in DCL1, but it's affected in RDR6 and DCL234. It could be transacting, because that kind of going away in RDR6 is unusual. It's why we put it up here. This one is just a regular siRNA, and it comes up with the probe for the sense and the antisense, as you might expect. So in the last part, I just want to tell you our experiences with the most recent development from the same company that we had done the MPSS with. The reason MPSS is kind of in the past, if you will, is because they have a much better technology that will, like 454 sequencing, go all the way through the small RNA, and it goes much deeper and it's much cheaper. So we've just started our very first experiments with this. It uses a bridge PCR for the amplification, and it deposits the cDNA on a slide as kind of polonies, if you will. And then the bridge PCR will amplify it at that location, and then it's sequenced with a series of chain terminator that are reversible in a dideoxy method. Yeah.
We didn't have this type of sequencing problem. Would you mind maybe to indicate a little bit more about the problem?
Oh, I can. It's sequencing by synthesis. Essentially these little polonies are just attached to the microscope slide, and then they're amplified by touching down and like making this little loop. And essentially it makes a whole cluster at that location. And the key is to get it distributed so that those clusters give you a high density but not on top of each other. And then these clusters can then be sequenced with these dye terminators. And they're reversible, and then they're all fluorescent, different colors, and you can see those from the usual way. But it's the old MPSS wasn't anything like dideoxy. It was a really involved by ligation and annealings and things like that, whereas this is just a dideoxy sequencing. It differs from 454 in the sense that it's not a coupled reaction. And so it doesn't have any kind of problem with homopolymers, for example. With a coupled reaction, sometimes hard to see, if you put T there, how many T's are going to go on in terms of the, like 7 or 8. And that's not a problem here. So I think you can clearly see that this kind of a technology wouldn't have that. But it gives us not as long a sequence. So for people who are doing other applications, it may not be as big an advantage because the sequence is only 25 to 30 nucleotides. However, if you go very deep, it could be giving you enough data to do resequencing. And there's calculations that say you can resequence the human genome with 25 nucleotide sequences if you can go very deep. And they can go very deep. So, it's at least as low as 454, and right now, the price is in a sort of stage where it's both sides, it's a little bit changing. So I think the thing that I notice is if you compare the cost of buying a machine and doing it yourself, there's a huge differential if you do this SBS. Whereas with 454, the amount of money you would save is modest, I would say, at least when we've been evaluating it. But with SBS, it could be quite dramatic. So in the SBS machine, there's 8 channels, okay? So in those channels, you can put like one sample, or as I'll show you, you can put coded samples, barcoded samples. And the amount that you're guaranteed when you send a sample there is 1 million reads from that channel. But typically, we're getting 2.5 million, and you can probably get more with time. It's just the very early stages. And there's 8 channels, and it costs the same if you have a machine to run all the channels at once. And the numbers I've heard are $3,000 to run all 8 channels, so you can see the differential would be quite high. They charge, I think their current price is $10,000 for a channel to run it, which is typical for a plate of 454. It's about $10,000 to run that. And that gives you 200 to 400 sequences, but you can go further deep, you can go longer. But in the case of SBS, it gives you, I would say, easily 1 million, if not 2 million sequences for for that same price. And if you buy a machine, you know, it's a huge investment, but then the differential between the supplies to run it and what you can do is huge. Whereas with 454, it's there is a savings, but it's not huge, at least at the current case. So to us, you know, that was one of the biggest advantages. We're getting 27 at the moment.
Because the programs are working, they're going longer and longer. They're now at 500 spaces, right? So are these Alexa guys also trying? Can they go longer? Is there some?
They can go longer. What the limit will be, we're not sure. But
it's like where is, so to speak, the limiting factor?
I'm not sure what that is, other than the fact that the errors are too high if they go further right now. But I'm not sure that I know what is the reason why it gets more error-prone as it goes longer. It could be that, you know, you have a decrease in the number of molecules that are still able to be elongated with these things, because there's, you know, a fair amount of reactions going on. But I'm not an expert in what their limitations are right now, other than the fact that if we go further, we can ask for further, you know, reads, but then the error rate goes up.
And the error is not controlled, so they don't tell you which particular sequence has an error. Isn't that what?
Well, I mean, they do tell you at each cycle, you know, whether, well, they tell you, they kind of give you some filtration data or some data about the quality, and you can either cut for that or you can get them to cut that off. But in terms of each sequence one by one, I'm not sure they know whether it, they don't look whether it matches the genome or something like that. But they can, you know, report whether that overall sequence, all the scores were good enough to pass their cutoffs, and you can look at that kind of information. I think there's a lot more of the raw data, but I don't see the original data that Blake gets. But I think we don't deal with it, at least at the first level, with all those scores. We haven't done that yet. We just kind of take what they say is good and work from there, similar to 454. So, but this data is very new. I mean, it's within the last month, so we haven't had as huge an experience with it. And we've been interested, our lab, in looking at abiotic stress responses with looking for which microRNAs are associated with that. So we used four index samples for the SBS sequencing: control, dehydration, salt, and salt and high temperature stress. And we sequenced this in collaboration with Illumina in one channel, all four of those together, and we used a two-base code, so two letters at the beginning that would tell us what sample was which. And then we also did one individual channel for each one. And all the data I'm showing you is just all put together for this. And we expected that the sequencing complexity would be low and that we would be missing numerous siRNAs because we used the RDR2 background. We wanted to enrich for the microRNAs and be able to pool, you know, a bunch of barcoded samples for that reason. And we used we expected fewer small RNAs because we were using seedlings to do these stresses, and that wasn't the best source of small RNAs. So these are just the summary statistics that we got. We sequenced 5 million molecules with SBS. And if we filter those for genome matching as well as remove all the tRNAs and ribosomals, this gave us a total non-redundant set of about 1.5 million. And then if we look all the way through at the ones that were distinct sequences that were the union of all of these, actually, then what we got was, and this is actually the non-redundant set, not that, I made a mistake. So the non-redundant set is 62,781, which is quite a bit larger than the 9,000 that I showed you before from the flower sample. So we really elevated the number of small RNAs that we could identify from this set. And now we're working very hard to try to find the interesting ones. They were, as we would expect, mostly 21 nucleotides in size in terms of the abundance of all the ones that were in that group. But if you look at them on, in terms of the distinct sequences, they're still mostly siRNAs. And so the distinct sequences are mainly 24 nucleotides with a bunch that are sort of intermediate sizes as well. So. That's right. Well, so what sometimes happens is you see some 22s a little bit more clearly there in that one, because there are quite a number of 22s. The Dicer 2 makes those, and I wouldn't rule out that some of the others, you know, make that as well. There's some staggering with the Dicer 1 where it cleaves exactly. Sometimes it's N plus 1, N plus another, so that might contribute to some of that, but we don't know all of the 22s, which enzyme they come from, for you know, obvious reasons. We can't completely eliminate Dicer activity. As you mentioned, it's embryo lethal, so at least with the tools that we have now, we can't eliminate it. So we were able to identify 37 families in the SBS data, and then we could, and that corresponded to 98 loci. About 23, at least at the time when there were 131 named micros in the Sanger registry, 23 of the families weren't identified. And of those that we didn't identify, nearly all of them were either never experimentally observed, so they, you know, had come from some other computational approach, or they're very low abundance in the seedling, which was the organ that we used. So I think that was a pretty good representation. And then in this Venn diagram, we just represented the different treatments, control, dehydration, and so forth. And we've been interested in at least one example that we identified just as a quick check came out of this category, which was found in all of them, but it was associated with all of the abiotic stresses in our experiment, elevated in all three relative to the control one. And that's just shown here as an example. It turned out to be one of the family members of one of the known micros, microRNA 396, and on this plot you can see it's high temperature and salt and cold and drought and even a little bit in dark compared to loading controls and microRNAs that aren't regulated by that. And so we think this will be a rich source to get at some of the small RNAs associated with stress. And where would this be going in the future? Well, we'd like to get as many microRNA target RNA pairs into multi-network diagrams, multi-network modeling approaches, because I think for in large part, these components are missing from a lot of the systems biology model building that's going on. So we're collaborating with Gloria Caruzzi and Rodrigo Gutierrez to put these pairs into their multi-network system, and we've started to do that a little bit in order to connect some of the components that are already there, and this will allow us to form some better hypotheses. These are just a couple of microRNA and microRNA pairs that have gone through, and they actually made some interesting predictions that make sense. But we have a lot more to do to incorporate the ones that are related to abiotic stress, and Caruzzi and Gutierrez are interested also in nitrogen and carbon levels and nitrogen stress. So I think it'll be just one of the beginnings of trying to get these pairs into these models to allow us to use this kind of information that we'll focus on in the future. I just tell you very briefly that we've also used SBS sequencing in maize, which has a genome that's 2,500 megabases, so it's much bigger than rice and bigger than Arabidopsis. And what's interesting there is that the lab of Vicky Chandler has a mutant that's analogous to the RDR2 mutant, and she found it in maize because it suppressed a gene silencing that she'd been studying for a long time. So this mutant is called MOP1, and it's related to RDR2, as you can see here in these RDR diagrams. And in maize, there's this kind of silencing called paramutation, and when Vicky looked for mutants that were deficient in paramutation, then looked for suppressors, what she found, when she looked at mutants that were deficient in paramutation, one of them turned out to be this MOP1, and it was knocking out RDR2. So this kind of paramutation or silencing was probably dependent on a similar function like RDR2. So we were interested to sequence that that mutant together with Vicky. And so RDR, excuse me, this MOP1 is required to silence this this particular gene in this locus called B prime. And so the silencing was thought to involve small RNAs, and they've actually been able to see those small RNAs on the B prime locus by gels, but we were able to also add some data to that, you know, looking at the wild type and in the mutant. A number of these small RNAs were lost. I'm not going to go through that because that's really Vicky's part of the story, but I'll just show you a little bit of the data from the genomic side, from the SBS side, so you can get an idea of the level of reads. And we got 2.8 million from each, the wild type and the MOP1, and that gave us quite a few distinct sequences after we cleaned up the data. And it's interesting in maize, that the 22 nucleotide peak is a little bit higher than the 21 nucleotide peak. And then there's a 24 nucleotide peak that's really large. And in the mutant, you can see this 22, 21 really dramatically when that 24 goes away. And what's interesting there is that that sometimes you see a lot of 22 nucleotide or less, 21 and 22, in the MOP1 mutant when the 24s are diminished. And this is seen in a number of loci. And again, we're in the process of analyzing this data, but you can see that in these two examples. So you still see small RNAs on the locus, but the distribution changes. And some of that might be an enrichment situation, but it also might not be, because it's not on every locus. For example, here's a locus that shows a different pattern. In the wild type, you see a lot of 24s, and they just simply go down in MOP1, but you don't see this elevation of 22. So I think that analyzing the different sizes in this mutant will be interesting and hopefully quite a bit different from Arabidopsis. And the fact that you get a lot of multiple hits to the genome in rice, and this is a bigger genome, more repeated, comes through in the case of maize. Now, maize genome's not sequenced yet, but it will be soon. There's a couple of larger contigs that we've used to match these sequences to the genome, and we use about 15 million bases. And what you can see here is, in that case, there's still, more. This is the maize line of how many things hit the genome more than once, or how many times they hit the genome, I should say. And these are the two contigs in maize that have been matched. And you can see that there's a trend that looks like it's going to be, a lot of small RNAs that are highly duplicated. And as we get the whole genome, it could be even more dramatic. So it's just an introduction to the situation. In the future, we're going to be looking at this more broadly and sequencing a large number of plant small RNAs. We were recently funded by NSF to look at 32 different species of small RNAs scattered throughout the plant kingdom, including some algae, doing 3 index samples for each one. And there's multiple species that have been chosen within the Poaceae, like the cereals and the Solanaceae, typified by, say, tomato. And so, well, they were selected mainly as trying to be nodes in evolution, best we could, and some were just interesting, but a number of them were selected by other genome projects as being nodes, and so we're trying to correlate with those. And then we went further down into the algae because we were interested to see where there was a break. It looks like in Chlamydomonas we don't see any microRNA homology between that and plants, but we're curious about whether CARA, we'll show that, because it's actually closer. If you look, it could be a point where there could be some that are similar to higher plants, but maybe not. In other people's studies, at least, some of the microRNAs are conserved down into lower plants. And then some of these are just interesting species that people had felt would be economically important.
Have you seen living fossil plants like
We've thought about it, and in fact, we're going to have one or two additional species, and we're trying to work it out where our funds will stretch more as the prices change, and we're going to take some community, suggestions for that. So I think that'll be particularly interesting. And so we imagine that The technologies will change a lot. Now MPSS is out of the picture. 454 is being used, but the depth is so limiting compared to SBS. You know, I at least in our case, we're probably not going to use 454, you know, routinely for most of our smaller RNA sequencing, because we can do a lot more for the money with SBS. And I think that will go up a lot more than 2 million. And then ABI and other companies are trying to get even deeper. And this will allow us to look at different species, but also use it as a routine technology for pull down experiments and different mutants and things like that. I'm sorry.
I'm just curious, how did you come up with this 25 million?
In discussions from the company, you know, but whether it's really going to be that way, we haven't used the technology yet. So, you know, it could be also that SBS can go more than 5 million easily, at least in terms of DNA sequencing. From a small RNA, we've been getting, you know, 2 to 3 million, but it's very early days. So I think it could easily go to 5 million. Whether it'll be at 25 in a channel, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, maybe ABI can do that. This is based on the Polony kind of a method from George Church's lab. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. We'll be eager to try it. And we're not wedded to work with one company or another. We've moved back and forth as the technology changed. We start with MPSS, then we went to 454, and now we're back at SBS. And if ABI is better, you know, that's hopefully the way we'll go as well. And finally, let me just acknowledge that most of the, all the computational work that went into this, this huge amount, was done by Blake Myers' lab, and he's just been a wonderful collaborator throughout the work. And in his lab, all of these people contributed to the studies that I showed you. Probably a couple of others have helped even more recently. And most of the experimental work that I showed you was done by really talented research assistant professor Chang Liu. And Fred Saray, when he was in the lab, he just recently moved to a company. But he did the target cleavage work and all the microRNA work together with Monica Serby, research associate. And then Donghong Jiang is a new postdoc, been working on the rice abiotic stress, and he's done some of the work with Chang Liu on the Arabidopsis abiotic stress, and Rana German's also assisted. And we've had some really great collaborations throughout this work. In particular, I mentioned Vicky Chandler's work with the MOP1, and Christian Hundersgeild has helped us a lot in SelectSource now called Illumina, and Steve Jacobson in particular too, and these granting agencies for assistance. So.
Are your RDR2 mutants healthy, or do they have some infertile phenotype, perhaps?
We haven't noticed any phenotype, and most people don't. It's a null mutant, but in subsequent generations, when that whole pathway has been diminished, like in a paper by Vaucheray, they do see some phenotypes. MOP1 has stochastic developmental phenotypes, but it's kind of different plants display different ones. So it's not been as dramatic as you might imagine that you would see, like this whole overall deficiency. And it takes quite some generations for the pathway to have, you know, a big impact. So
you do see the transposons hopping around?
We haven't looked at that at all. There is the potential for that to be affecting things, and you do see the lack of small RNAs on those, but then you also sometimes get other small RNAs there that are still there a little bit. So I think that it's probably, you know, going to have an impact in subsequent generations, as we've seen, but it's not as dramatic as one would imagine. Or in some of the methylation mutants, you can see the phenotypes a lot more, you know, but sometimes they take a few generations to see as well. So yeah, that's the kind of question that comes up a lot. They're much more modest phenotypes than you would expect from that kind of inactivation.
And another question regarding the adjuvant arrays, could you see any sensitivity of how abundant the microRNAs are in the signaling? I mean, if you see them or not, but if you see the overrepresentation, or the one that you are missing was the one that was very difficult to get, also with a smaller number.
Well, I couldn't say that for sure. At the low end, as many people have seen, the adjuvant arrays are not, you know, incredibly good, and it. It's also an issue of if the fold change is really low, it's really hard for us to be sure that we're seeing that. And so, you know, yeah, so that's where we've had the most trouble. And any smaller changes, and also in finding small changes that we know are reproducible by blots, we can't often see them in the adjuvant arrays. Now, I haven't used a number of other platforms for the same thing. We haven't used anything else for smalls. But I know that in some comparisons, for just looking at mRNAs, that people have said that adjuvant arrays at the low end weren't the best arrays. So it could just be that.
I think Affymetrix has done nothing on plants until now.
Well,
there has been a lot with Affymetrix, smaller names.
Yeah, they may have something by now, but I haven't seen it used in, you know, in any talks that I've seen. You know, the tiling arrays don't cover exactly all of the micros just because of their 25 nucleotides, so they have to kind of be right centered, but they do cover some of them. But mostly the tiling array data, say by Joe Ecker, has been overlapped with some smaller RNA data from our lab from our project or from Carrington's project and David Bartel's project, both of which have, you know, done a tremendous amount of sequencing. And other groups now have done a lot of work, you know, precipitating or pulling down the smaller RNAs of like the different AGOs or things of that kind. So I think that we're going to see a lot more of, you know, in the future. After we published ours, right after that, all the PWE papers came down. A couple of those had used 454 to sequence the PWE associated, associated small RNA. So I think this is, you know, just going to be a much more routine technique. And like you said, looking in the nucleus and other subcompartments that we can get hold of, nucleoli would be good. I have some pictures of like this Pol IV business I can show later if you want to get into it. But I think, you know, since the time is kind of late, we could talk about that question you had, you know, with the Pol IVs.
Okay, we can.
Yeah, after I can show you a picture of where they're thought to be in the cell and everything. I didn't do anything. It's all data of other people, but I just have a couple slides of their work, but I didn't. So we did Pol IV mutants with Steve Jacobson, just recently published, where we were looking at how the Pol IV knockouts would look, you know, and they, you know, they look similar to the pathways we've been, you know, examining. And Steve also made the F1 between the Pol IVA and B knockouts.